Welcome to Postmortem. I'm your host, Anne-Marie Green, and today we're actually discussing a case that I reported on with 48 Hours producer Murray Weiss. It's about the murder of Kevin Jeong and the incredible investigative work done by multiple law enforcement agencies, including the U.S. Marshals, to find his killer. Murray, it's always good to see you. Thanks for joining me to break down this case.
My pleasure seeing you again.
As usual, a reminder to everyone, if you haven't listened to this 48 Hours episode yet, you can find the full audio version just below this episode in your podcast feed. So go take a listen and then come on back so we can talk about this. All right, Murray. So this case has so many layers to it, but there were different narratives, I think, that jumped out to both of us. You know, you're a longtime New York City crime reporter. You've, you know, gone after mobsters and you name it. And I was really fascinated by the characters, if you will. Here you have two young men. They're the only sons in their family, only children. They are incredibly talented and bright. They get into these prestigious universities. I mean, the world is kind of like their oyster. They can go any way that they want. And then they take these divergent paths in life. They're almost like two sides of the same coin. But your crime reporter mind was drawn to this case in sort of a different way. How did you approach it?
Well, I agree with everything you said. You know, this is like an American dream story, but it's an American dream story, obviously, that turns into a nightmare. Our challenge is, how do we take this complicated story that involves two extraordinary gifted people, and one of whom is murdered by another one, and try to tell it to the viewer so that it's clear what has happened here? And I think the approach I decided was that there were a string of shootings that occurred in New Haven in advance of Kevin's murder. And that might be the starting point to introduce the viewers into what the police were seeing from the get-go. So it's a way of introducing the enormity of the not just the murder, but the investigative side of it, and ultimately how it led to this extraordinary person who turned out to be the killer.
Indeed. And, you know, as we reveal in the story, what really broke the case open was when investigators discovered that there actually was a connection between Pan and Kevin, but it was not a very obvious one at all. They searched Pan's Facebook account, and they found that he was connected to Kevin's fiance, Zion Perry, who also attended MIT. Investigators told us that Pan first met Zion through this Christian group at MIT, you know, like a social group, but their interactions were kind of fleeting.
Correct. Once they got Pan's name and they determined he was from MIT, they couldn't find a connection to Kevin. But then when they did see her name, Zion Perry, the fiance, they actually went to talk to her. And she was stunned that they even mentioned his name to her, because her interactions were so minor that she had already graduated from MIT. She had moved on to Yale.
Right. And Pan was never more than an acquaintance to Zion. There was no romance between them. She had no idea that he was even interested in her.
The leading theory that the investigators had was that he somehow was fixated on her,
yeah.
You know, that there was some sort of obsession. There was a telling part where when she graduated, he reached out to try to, you know, have a FaceTime congratulatory, you know, meeting with her. And she declined. And in fact, she posted the engagement proposal, the video of the proposal, only a week before Kevin was murdered.
And we just want to remind people that it's never been determined that Zion was actually the motivation for this murder. We still don't know why Pan did what he did. And we did try to talk to Zion as well, but she declined.
But we got full cooperation from the detectives and the law enforcement people, all of whom spoke to her. I mean, these are extraordinary moments for homicide detectives where they have to go and break tragic news to families and relatives of people, Zion Perry and the mom. I mean, they're completely crushed, crying, sobbing, disbelief. And yet the homicide people ultimately have to, you know, they become steely, and their goal is to get information out of the key principal players, really, that are going to hopefully provide some leads that lead them to the killer.
So let's actually get into that, because the level of premeditation for this is astounding to me. These shootings that happened before Kevin's murder, in order to do them, Pan used different vehicles. He was able to get test drives from these dealerships, which I thought was so interesting because, I mean, I haven't gone out to test drive a vehicle in a while, but usually the salesperson comes with you. He was able to grab these vehicles, disappear for a few hours, and then come back. There are a few other details that we didn't really get to in the hour, according to U.S. Marshals. When he would go to these dealerships, he would ask a series of curious questions. He would recline in the seats to see if he could lie down. And investigators speculated that he was scoping out these cars to see if he could actually hide in them.
According to the police, he actually asked not only reclining in the seats, that he wanted to go camping and maybe he'd be sleeping in it. He talked about the trunks. In a couple of cases, he actually said he was going to show it to his mechanic to check out the car for him. And investigators said, they later determined that the dates that he convinced these dealership owners to lend him the car for a test drive, he actually came down to Connecticut, fired bullets at these different homes. Now, this was in December, starting in December of 2020.
Right.
So the game plan, according to the police, was to commit these random shootings. And then when Kevin was killed, they would never, ever think that somebody who's in Massachusetts, who's an MIT student, was coming down to another state and is in New Haven committing these crimes.
Right.
So it was very, very well thought out. Very, very well thought out, very pre-planned.
But here's the thing, you know, there's an incredible amount of planning for this. But the one thing it seems like Penn doesn't plan for very well is how to get away. And that's what really jams him up. You know, he tries to flee the scene, but he ends up in a scrap metal yard and he is stopped by law enforcement there.
Well, that's a fascinating turn. Supervisory Assistant State Attorney Stacey Miranda even said at the sentencing that Pan could have possibly gotten away had he not been stuck there on the railroad tracks. And I think in this case, the theory is he drove into this scrapyard metal, that he knew it was there, and that it would be a safe and smart place to discard a murder weapon. And if you're in it actually is the largest scrapyard in all of Connecticut, that place. But also, cleverly, the scrapyard is very near the interstate highway, so it's very convenient for getting. Not only you could drive into it, throw the gun away, come out. I mean, this is part of the theory that the investigators have, that he would come out of the yard and then go back, get on the highway and drive to Massachusetts and nobody would be the wiser.
And we should point out that, in fact, the murder weapon was never found.
No.
And that Sergeant Mills that you see in the hour, this guy is like a dedicated officer, man. And he went back to that scrap metal yard several times, looking for this gun.
Well, you should note, he's the one who responded to the 911 call.
Right, exactly. So he went back on his own time to look for this weapon, you know, in that yard, and it was just never found. And I will point out one more thing about his encounter with Pan. It didn't rise to the level of particular concern for him.
Well, to a point you made earlier, it was a vehicle from a dealership, and the dealership had gave him the car, so it wasn't reported stolen or anything. Right. And probably even more importantly, Mr. Pan, the motorist, was extremely calm, and he had a clean criminal background, his license of his own, and he just seemed like a guy who got lost, and Sergeant Mills was, no harm, no foul here kind of thing. He didn't even know that a murder had been committed, much less a crime that fit a description of the car.
So let's talk a little bit more about Sergeant Mills. I see him as kind of a cop's cop. The guy's really dedicated to his job. And in fact, on the day that he got the call to go to the Arby's, it was like he was working a half day. He was going to go coach hockey. But he gets this call to go to the Arby's to investigate the gun and the ammunition that was left in the parking lot.
And by coincidence, Sergeant Mills, he responded to the 911 call the night before of the guy down the track and convinced Pang to go to a Best Western hotel overnight, which is right next door to the Arby's. So right. The following morning, when that 911 call came in, and when he got there, he saw the clothing, he saw a bag that he recognized was in the vehicle that he had helped the night before. By then, he knew there was a homicide in New Haven that involved a dark SUV. This is one brave character. I mean, he knows that he's going to go to the Best Western and he's going to try to speak to a man that may be a murderer and committed a very brutal murder just the night before. Yeah. So he's a guy who's willing to walk up to you and confront you if you're a killer. And
absolutely.
I give him a lot of credit and courage to be able to do that.
Welcome back. So when the U.S. Marshal gets involved in this case, they knew that King Chin Pan was on the run. He's very smart. He's tech savvy. So their sort of first order was to kind of get into his mind, figure out who this guy is.
Correct. And not only that, to see what kind of resources he has around him. They checked the financial records and saw that his parents had made a modest withdrawal of money on the night that he disappeared in New Haven from the hotel. You know, one of the marshals said something like, there's two difficult types of fugitives for us to track. There's the ones who have no resources, no help, and are desperate. Then the other ones are the ones who have resources and intelligence. And those are probably more difficult to track and more dangerous. And they said he fit into that category.
One of the things that the marshal said to us is that Pan thought he was the smartest guy in the room. And when they spoke to someone who he had interviewed with for, I think it was a coding job, that guy said, yeah, you know, he's really smart. He's an MIT guy. But, you know, his coding actually wasn't as good as he thought it would be. So he's a smart guy, but maybe he thought he was smarter than he actually was.
Yeah, that's what the marshals were told when they went around scoping out stuff on him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it gave him additional hope that he wasn't as sharp as they thought, because if you recall, his attorney described him as a genius who was studying artificial intelligence, and he was an MIT student. So at the end of the day, he had a shortcoming, clearly, and he didn't get that job. But that didn't make him any less a formidable foe, if you will, for the marshals to track.
U.S. marshals actually finally tracked down Pan by tracing a phone call made to him from his mom. She used the phone of a hotel clerk.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary moment for the marshals, actually, in my opinion. You know, it took months before they actually caught up with Mr. Pan there. But that phone call for them was a eureka moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that number led them to a boarding house in Alabama, where they sent a team of marshals, hopefully to find Mr. Pan.
And I just want to sort of reinforce that Pan's parents, they were never charged with anything in connection with Kevin's murder or Pan being on the run or anything along those lines.
Correct.
But speaking of a team, we're talking about 20 people were sent to arrest Pan. Matthew Duffy, supervisor of the U.S. Marshals Violent Fugitive Task Force in Connecticut, called this team a small army. That seems like a lot.
You know, these are people who are trying to find somebody who has committed a extraordinarily vicious murder. He's been on the run for 3 months. They know that he had pre-planned this. He had already committed 4 other shootings. So how do you want to approach somebody like that? The simple answer is there's safety in numbers here. And it's very wise because if it prevents the suspect from getting violent, it actually not only protects the law enforcement people, but any other people who were in that boarding house at the time.
Well, it worked. They got their man and no one was hurt in the process.
He just came out and said, I'm your guy that you're looking for.
He did. Yeah, totally. So there are still a number of unanswered questions here, right? And one of them is, you know, why? Why did this happen? And we attempted to actually talk to Pan and ask him that question, right?
We wanted to see if he would confirm what the theory of the police were, you know, that there was some sort of hidden obsession.
It didn't work out for us, though.
No, unfortunately, he didn't want to. At the end of the day, he was yes, no, but no.
So that question remains unanswered, at least at this point.
Yeah.
So Pan initially pled not guilty and was sticking to that for quite a while. Eventually, though, there was a tremendous amount of evidence. He agreed to plead guilty. In the hour, we see some of his statement at sentencing, but we want to play an extended clip for you.
Your Honor, what I'm reading about is my action and the horrible consequences. I'm thinking about, as I learned, that the victim was an only child. The victim's family came from Taiwan to the U.S. to a new place, and the victim's mom had to raise him by herself. The victim was also a devout Christian. Did missionary work in Taiwan and was a promising student at Yale. I feel sorry for what my actions caused and for everyone affected.
It was a very emotional kind of sentencing.
The lead up to that was victim impact statements were made for about an hour. Kevin's mom spoke, other people spoke, people that were friends with him with the military, and his fiance Zion Perry spoke. And during that entire presentation of victims' statements, and there were some of them were enormously sad, and they spoke about Kevin and the loss of Kevin, you know, in front of the judge. He just sat there, Pan, through the entire thing, looking kind of down, not at any of the people who were speaking. The only time he actually turned and to look at the podium where they were speaking was when Zion Perry spoke. And that was shortly before he allocuted for himself. Then he accepted his plea and admitted, you know, what he did and expressed remorse for it.
We talked a little bit about this earlier, that Kevin Jeong was just an absolutely remarkable human being, so much so that we almost, I don't think we could put everything in the hour, you know, dedicated to his studies and dedicated to his military endeavors. He was just sort of dedicated to being a good human.
I've been around the crime stories a long time. You'd be shocked how many tens of thousands of murders I've actually covered. Kevin was absolutely one of the most remarkable young people to be, mm-hmm. you know, caught up in such a sad, tragic story. I mean, he worked with the homeless. He cared for his mom. He was at Yale and studying the environment. Kevin had a YouTube channel that was dedicated to teaching fitness and health. And his fiance, you know, their pastor, if you recall, made a very telling remark about them that their achievements as students wasn't really their touchstone. It was, you know, their deeds and what they planned on doing together in life. And that was very rare.
And, you know, we talked earlier about the two families here. In the show, you see the virtual vigil and Kevin's dad is speaking and he is by far the most emotional out of everyone that you see. And here's what people don't know is that Kevin comes from a divorced family. And one of the things that we learned from Kevin's friends is that Kevin and his dad had not been very close for a number of years. And they had actually started to rekindle that relationship. And in fact, he went to go visit his dad with Zion and they were rebuilding those connections. And so to have his son ripped away from him at such a crucial time, it just sort of adds to the sadness of this whole thing.
Yeah, 100%. And that vigil you referenced, nearly 700 people got on that vigil. It was during the pandemic, so you had to, you know, make an effort to get on a Zoom.
It's just an incredible waste and an incredibly heartbreaking case. But I have to tell you, Murray, it was also a very complicated story to tell. And the way you weaved all the elements together, I thought was just exceptional. And it was fantastic working with you.
Thank you very much. Same here.
Well, I want to thank everyone for listening to this hour. Listen, if you like this series, Postmortem, please rate and review 48 Hours on Apple Podcasts. You can follow 48 Hours wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also listen ad-free with a 48 Hours Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. Thanks again for listening.